Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Energy, Utilities, Environment, and Climate Committee. We are in room 1150. It is 12:30, and a quorum is present. Ladies and gentlemen, we have one bill on the agenda today. That, of course, is Senate File 486. Senator Dibble here is chief author with a fine list of witnesses. Members, I think we'll dive in. I know we're expecting a member or two to show up. Senator Dibble, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Should we start with the A2 Delete Everything Amendment?
Senator Dibble offers the A2 Amendment. We want to report that's an author's amendment. I believe everyone has a copy, Senator Dibble. Senator Dibble, do you want to speak to the amendment?
I'm sure I can present the amendment before we vote on it, Mr. Chair. I know it's a delete everything because we just added a lot of mostly technical elements to the underlying bill. And we decided, but there are just a lot of pieces to it. So it seemed easier to offer it as a delete everything because it was hard to engross with all the moving parts in it. So very quickly, Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to present Senate File 486, which would create an energy assistance program administered by the Department of Commerce as an adjunct or a complementary energy assistance effort to what we know as LIHEAP, the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program. A lot of people refer to it as the Heating Assistance Program, but it really is about energy assistance for people's households. And the crux of the idea, Mr. Chair and members, is to provide a supplemental grant program so that households and individuals can receive help to pay their utility bills throughout the year, including in the summertime months. Just by quick background, the LIHEAP program, which we're of course very familiar with every winter, we're waiting with bated breath to see what the LIHEAP award will be from the federal government. We of course add state dollars to help extend the help that LIHEAP offers. And we're familiar with it, of course, because you know, our winters are long, cold, and dark, and some people have a hard time paying their bills, and we need to make sure that people can stay warm throughout the wintertime. But with the changing nature of the climate, the volatility of temperatures in the summertime, it turns out that people are actually having a harder time paying their bills throughout the year and in the summertime, particularly, and they cannot be without electrical service or energy service in order to stay cool. The need for energy assistance far exceeds the availability of funds. Only about a quarter of those who are eligible, not that everyone is eligible necessarily needs help, but only about a quarter of those who qualify for low-income energy assistance actually receive energy assistance in Minnesota. As I mentioned before, assistance is not available when the majority of shutoffs occur, and that's in the summertime. And of course, that's when people need cooling, which has very, very serious health consequences and impacts. Most states, as it turns out, provide energy assistance in the summer, including North Dakota. We have worked with a whole array of stakeholders since we first had this conversation last biennium in this committee. To figure out how best to address the need. And of course, it's not to do so by creating a new program. This is adjunct, like I said, to an existing program using the existing infrastructure, the utilities, the CAP agencies, et cetera, with the procedures that are already set up for LIHEAP and the qualifications, et cetera. Our goal, of course, is to prevent utility shutoffs and people running out of delivered fuels by keeping the energy assistance program on throughout the summer, and allow a greater number of individuals who are eligible to receive this assistance. It's as much about energy as it is about housing, health, and family stability. And you look at the those who are testifying, we've got a lot of folks gathered around this idea who oftentimes don't agree with one another. Mr. Chair, to the bill itself, very quickly, the first section kind of sets up the definitions, establishes crisis grants.
Senator Dibble, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we still have the A2 moved but not adopted.
Correct.
Do you want to, you're the author, do you want us to adopt the A2?
Yes.
Do you want to speak to it? Okay.
Yeah.
Members typically grant the author, get it in the shape they want. All those in favor of adopting the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The A2 is adopted. Senator Dibble, back to you on the bill as amended.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So within the supplementary program, we, of course, define LIHEAP because that's the associated program. We establish a crisis grant for those who are in imminent danger of a shutoff, as well as an ongoing energy grant for those who need kind of ongoing assistance on a month-to-month basis with paying their bill. We establish the Supplemental Energy Assistance Grant Program, that's Subdivision 2, and describe what it is for. And then just direct the agency to develop the policies and procedures to govern the grant application and the awarding process, basically to mirror the existing LIHEAP program that we have. So that's Subdivision 3, paragraphs A, B, C. We say that these grant applications can be accepted throughout the year, and the funds would be available until they're exhausted. The eligibility would be those who are of fairly low income, less than, I think, well, most folks who are in the program as an individual are making $20,000 or less. Those of families of four making less than about $68,000. So the eligibility in terms of income thresholds is described. The priority, if we turn over to page 2, is to expand the number of households rather than expanding the size of each individual grant. And to the extent possible, use existing available program funds that we already have in the LIHEAP program before we turn to this source of funds for the supplemental program. We have the different types of grants described, the crisis grants, the primary energy in crisis grants to those households that did not receive LIHEAP funds. These grants would also be available for emergency heating system or repair. Emergency heating system repair or replacement, and some funds to support outreach so that we can reach as many people as possible. Then we have a whole raft of reporting requirements, and if you want to know more details, I'll go into that, but just suffice it to say we want to know who's getting the funds and where and all of that. That's the bill, Mr. Chair, and with me I have Annie Levison-Falk from CUB, who is ready to also talk about why this is such a great idea.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Well done. Ms. Levison-Falk, welcome to the committee. If you could start, please, by introducing yourself and giving your testimony. And ladies and gentlemen, a little forward spin, our next testifier would be Ron Elwood. I'm sorry, there's no bullet point there. The next testifier would be Jenny Glumack, and then the testifier after that would be Ron Elwood. And now there is a bullet on my agenda. Senator Dibble, thank you for that brief pause. Ms. Levison-Falk, fire away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Annie Levison-Falk, and I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota. We're a nonprofit advocate for Minnesota residential energy consumers. As committee members may recall, you've seen this bill before. We've been working on this proposal since 2022, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to present it today. The need is substantial, and I'll try to explain why. For many households, the cost of energy has been and continues to be unaffordable. A good measure of affordability is energy burden, the percent of household income that's spent on energy. This figure is very high for many Minnesotans, particularly in rural areas where incomes tend to be lower and where energy costs tend to be higher with lower population densities and the need to purchase delivered fuels. A rough rule of thumb is that an energy burden between about 4 to 6% is considered about the max that a household can bear. And there are large portions of greater Minnesota where the average household spends more than that. The affordability problems were exacerbated in the years following the pandemic when many Minnesotans faced financial strains. We saw utility arrears go way up. And those figures have come down somewhat since their peak, helped by the cost of natural gas coming back down. But arrears are still far above the norm. Customers of regulated utilities in Minnesota still owe about $100 million in past due bills. And that doesn't include the effects that we know are being felt by households that are served by cooperative or municipal utilities, or people who struggle with the $800 or $900 that you have to pay to get your propane tank refilled. With the compounding pressures of inflation going up, housing costs going up, households that were having trouble before are falling farther behind on utility bills. And utility shutoffs are also way up. In 2024, more than 91,000 Minnesota households were disconnected for non-payment. Citizens Utility Board has tracked this data going back for a decade, and that far exceeds any year for which we have data in the past. As Senator Dibble said, most of these shutoffs occur between June and September, after the cold weather rule protections expire and when there's no energy assistance available. Facing a utility shutoff can have really severe effects on a household. Research shows that about a third of Americans have gone without necessities like food or medicine in order to pay utility bills. 69% of Americans who took out a payday loan did so in order to pay a regular expense like a utility bill. And when there are heat waves or cold snaps, demand for payday loans surges. Lack of cooling during periods of extreme heat can be a serious health risk, particularly for seniors and other vulnerable individuals. And of course, cooling needs have dramatically increased in Minnesota in the 45 years since the LIHEAP program started. The average Twin Cities summer now requires 43% more cooling than it did in the early 80s. And that's why the majority of states provide energy assistance in the summer, including other northern states like North Dakota. We've worked hard with utilities, service providers, low-income advocacy groups, and dozens of stakeholders to provide a proposal to address these problems in an efficient manner. The structure of the proposal before you today basically mirrors the existing LIHEAP program so it can be integrated as seamlessly as possible. We understand the budget pressures that the state is under and appreciate your consideration of this pressing need.
Thank you, Ms. Levinson-Falk. Members, if everyone's okay with it, we'll hold all the questions until all the testifiers have gone and then maybe call those that are still here back up. Ms. Glumak, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself. And Mr. Elwood, you may have already heard, we're going to switch our testifier order. Ms. Amanda Mackey would be next, and then Mr. Elwood. All right, Ms. Glumak, welcome back. Introduce yourself, and please provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Jenny Glumak, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. We are, as a reminder, the Minnesota State Association that represents all 50 of the not-for-profit electric co-ops in Minnesota that provide power to 1.7 million member owners, and we cover 85% of the geography of Minnesota. I want to thank Senator Dibble for bringing this important bill forward. Electric cooperatives strive to deliver reliable, affordable, and safe electricity and are member-driven in this mission, as we are with every policy that runs through the energy committees. Like everyone else in Minnesota, rural Minnesota has certainly not escaped being touched by inflation, with upward pressure on goods and services, including energy. Electric cooperatives serve some of the poorest counties in the state and have some of the most vulnerable members that are members of our cooperatives, as noted by Annie before. We do see an annual trend where past due receivables build from the end of summer when electric bills can be some of the highest, and into October when resources become available. So having available resources throughout the year, including summer, would allow our cooperatives to better support their members and reduce the number of disconnects that occur annually, as well as levelize the demand for these resources, improving service and response times for recipients that receive energy assistance. So expanding the energy assistance program and keeping the program open through the summer months would really help this trend. So this, you know, we think this is a good bill to bring forward, and we hope that we can get this to the finish line this year.
Thank you very much, Ms. Glumak. Again, we'll have member questions when all the testifiers are done, so if you can hang around, that'd be great. Next, we'll have Amanda Mackey from Minnesota Valley Action Council, followed by Ron Elwood. Ms. Mackey, welcome to the committee. If you could start, please, by introducing yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Amanda Mackey, and I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Valley Action Council. We're a community action agency that delivers the low-income home energy program to the nine counties in South Central Minnesota. MVAC provided energy assistance to 9,200 households last year, ensuring that families and seniors are able to remain warm during our cold winter, Minnesota winters. I am here to support Senate File 486 to expand the federal low-income home energy assistance program to include benefits for those summer months. As you know, we're blessed to experience both the extremes of summer heat and winter cold in Minnesota, and it places a significant burden on our low-income households that we serve. At this time, we're only able to relieve a small portion of this burden during the winter months due to lack of adequate funding. Federal funding levels have dropped below what they were 15 years ago, which means smaller grants for households while energy costs continue to rise. In January, Xcel proposed a nearly 10% increase in their rates for 2025, which are going to hit our low-income consumers the hardest. Meanwhile, our customers are not experiencing corresponding increases in wages, especially our seniors that rely on their fixed incomes. Some report having to choose between paying for their medicine or their heat, a choice no one's grandparents should have to make in the cold Minnesota months. It's also critical to recognize that these lower funding levels reduces the resources that our agencies have and use to deliver these services. As we work with 2010 level funding, we're attempting to pay 2025 wages. So this means employing fewer staff to deliver the same level of service and to process the same number of applications. The reduced staffing also results in a delay in the release of grant funds to the energy providers. We, like many energy assistance service providers, have had to lay off staff in the summer once the LIHEAP program season has ended, which means hiring temporary staff to deliver the program, and that requires a significant training ramp-up time in the fall. This bill helps address some of these barriers by expanding assistance to cover that cooling season and allowing us to keep consistent staff running the program all year, which is a formula for a more efficient program. At the end of the normal energy assistance season and when the cold weather rule expires, we always see a significant increase in shutoffs and big utility bills in June when the cooling season begins, because households can't afford these increases in electric costs. The majority of MVAC's service area is rural, with aging housing stock averaging well over 40 years old, meaning less energy efficient homes that create an overburdening of costs for our consumers. A quick story about how energy assistance has helped someone. Jean came to MVAC with a shutoff notice last February from her heat vendor after her partner Jim had passed away. She found herself unable to keep up with bills. She'd been his longtime caregiver and had not worked outside of the home in many years, so she was relying on her small Social Security check. Because they had not married, she could not receive his partner benefits. She was embarrassed to ask us for help. She'd never been to MVAC before. She came in covering her mouth, speaking to our staff, because she had several broken and missing teeth. So our staff helped her get her heat turned back on and then referred her that day using our crisis funds. Because we're Community Action, we run a lot of different programs, and we contacted our senior employment program, and she began working at our thrift store as part of subsidized employment. But she was such a great worker that we soon hired her as a regular employee with full benefits. In December, she came into my office to show me her new dentures that she was now able to afford with her dental insurance. And she just couldn't stop smiling and talking about how much just coming in for energy assistance turned her life around. And she cried through happy tears telling us this. So she really credits LIHEAP on getting her life turned around and back on her feet. Thank you for this opportunity to share my testimony and about this important bill. And I urge you to advance this bill to ensure that Minnesota is able to provide a year-round robust energy program to support some of our most vulnerable households.
Thank you, Ms. Mackey. If I'm not mistaken, you do have to leave. Okay. Well, then if you could hang out, maybe there'll be member questions at the end. You're welcome to stay. It's open committee. Thank you for the testimony. Mr. Elwood, introduce yourself and present your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Really, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate File 486. A couple of facts for your consideration. In Minnesota, these are Minnesota stats, one out of every two recipient households of LIHEAP is a person with a disability or has a person with a disability in their home. One out of every two, 50%. 4 in 10 are senior citizens or have a senior citizen in the household. 16% of recipients have a child under 6. And this is a national, the next stat is national. We don't have Minnesota data, I couldn't find it. 20% of LIHEAP recipients are veterans. So to elaborate a little bit on Ms. Levinson's Falk's point about the need in rural Minnesota, the energy burden for folks in rural Minnesota, again, energy burden is the percentage of income paid towards energy, is 42% higher than it is in urban areas. So Senate File 486 would significantly help our vulnerable neighbors in Minnesota. One more statistic. According to the Greater Twin Cities United Way, 36% of Minnesotans struggle to meet basic needs, which of course includes energy. And it's been unquestionably documented that people in this predicament face energy insecurity, which in turn can lead to dire consequences, including, as Ms. Mackey pointed out, the impossible dilemma of a heat or eat. Do I pay for food? Do I pay for utilities? The health consequences of going without food are especially hard on children and seniors and can lead to serious health issues, which is not good for them, not good for their families, nor is it good for our state. Financially struggling Minnesotans may have to decide whether to pay rent or pay utilities. The choice for utilities, in the depth of the cold winter or the height of the blistering summer, if you choose to pay for utilities, you can wind up homeless or evicted, another terrible outcome for all concerned. One particularly strong benefit of Senate File 486 is that it would enable energy assistance to be available year-round, which means help with cooling in the summer. There is debate among experts about whether more people die from the heat or from the cold, but whatever the answer to that is, people die from both. And energy assistance saves lives. And finally, energy assistance helps prevent utility shutoffs and reduces uncollectibles, which improves the financial health of utilities and reduces the impact on ratepayers. So for all these reasons, I would urge your support for this bill, and I thank you for the opportunity to share some information with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Well done. Next, we have Jamie Fitzke from CenterPoint and Mr. Shardlow on deck. Ms. Fitzke, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Good afternoon, everyone. Jamie Fitzke with CenterPoint Energy. I would like to thank Senator DeBille, co-authors, and those involved with this bill, especially the CAP agencies, who are often key in the community connections. CenterPoint Energy is Minnesota's largest heating utility, and we support this bill. What this bill would do it is complement federal LIHEAP efforts, as there's always more need than the available funds. LIHEAP administration is often a community connector, and it is used often for utility income qualified programs, including low income energy efficiency programs. With having this additional funding, we would have an opportunity to create potential program efficiencies by allowing year-round access. What this would end up doing is smoothing out some of the demand that takes place through the cycles through the LIHEAP programs. Just would like to say that if there is funding available, this is a worthy and broadly supported effort. This concludes my testimony, and I thank you for the time.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzke. Mr. Shardlow, nice to see you again. Please introduce yourself and present your testimony. Following Mr. Shardlow, Kent Sulem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is George Shardlow, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Energy Sense Coalition. For over 35 years, ECC has advocated on behalf of low-income utility customers. We are also a third-party administrator for Greater Minnesota Gas's Affordability Program, as well as both Xcel Energy's Affordability and Low-Income Home Weatherization Program. All of these programs target LIHEAP recipients, and they all enjoy administrative efficiencies from using receipt of LIHEAP as proof of income. Income verification is necessary to ensure resources to go to those who truly need them, but it can be onerous and often prevents us from getting resources out the door. Therefore, the benefits of this bill extend beyond the grants it will award. A longer application window will place more applicants in a pipeline to be vetted and improved. It will place them in an assistance pipeline to help them afford their bill today through energy assistance and afford it tomorrow through hopefully a lower bill once their dwelling units have been weatherized. LIHEAP dollars are federal funds that all too often go underutilized. Keeping the application window open year-round will conform to the practices of some of our most conservative neighboring states, and it's not unlike the State Competitiveness Fund in that we are directing state dollars to unlock and maximize federal dollars at the same time. More importantly, this will help us fulfill our most basic obligation as a society, keeping our neighbors safe. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Shardlow. Our next testifier is Kent Sulem. Do we have members who wanted to question Mr. Shardlow? Senator Gruenhagen, I have you on the list, but you're okay waiting. All right. Thank you for that, members. Thank you, Mr. Sulem. Please introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kent Sulem, Director of Government Relations and Senior Counsel for the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. I'd like to thank Senator Dibble for bringing this bill forward. As you may know, our members, the 120 electric and 33 gas utilities owned by the city, means that the customer is the friends, neighbors, constituent of the governing bodies. And so the more programs that are available to help the individuals, the better it is for the entire community. It helps prevent shutoffs, it helps prevent rates having to be shuffled to other the backs of others to make up for the losses. And so we are very supportive of Senate File 486. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem. Before we go to member questions, are there any members of the public who wanted to testify but did not get a chance to talk to the committee administrator? All right, seeing none, we're going to go to Senator Matthews first, Senator Gruenhagen, and then Senator Hoffman. Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Dibble, for bringing this bill forward. I have a couple comments that I want to make, first in general and then some specific ones about the bill. First, I want to point out that now that we have gone back to the one vote margins here in committee, I do want to highlight that it is interesting now that it's one party controlling things. Now we have bills coming forward through the committee when none of this was taking place when we were in an even split. So we had, as was pointed out on the floor, we had minority members here that were actively trying to go around and get support for bills that were wanting to be heard. And that was not being done the other way. Now, Senator Dibble, to your credit, you did reach out with a very descriptive email afterwards, giving me a preview of this bill and asking for support, and I do greatly appreciate that. I do want to highlight that for the committee. That is something that we need to continue to do for this whole process if we're going to be moving forward. With the bill that is before us, I can't help but think about how this is for a worthy endeavor. None of us here want to see people that get their heat shut off in the wintertime, that gets their AC shut off in the summertime. There are people that are in need of help, that need some extra assistance. This bill is not able to do any more than be a patchwork stopgap for a current problem that someone is facing. We've had in this committee for the past couple years active bills that have gone through that have increased the price of energy for everybody. And now we're here a couple years later, we need to expand our assistance programs to be able to come and help a greater number of people that now are gonna struggle with their utility costs because their utility and their energy prices are higher for everybody. And I'm looking over the audience and I am seeing people that have come here that have advocated for passing bills that increase the price of energy that are now also here asking for us to support a bill that will help with funding and helping people cover the expenses now that their energy is more important. I want to help folks out across the state of Minnesota, including our vulnerable members. by helping reduce the actual cost of energy, by helping increase the supply and not just increase demand while decreasing the supply. And then where needed, have programs like this available for those that are still needing assistance. I want to ask questions of the CAP program folks, if they would be able to come back to the table.
Which testifier? Ms. Mackey? Thank you for coming back up. Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, maybe I'll ask this to Senator Dibble first. Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, do the CAP programs fully utilize all of these grants through the state of Minnesota, or do they only administer a portion of them? And if it's just a portion, who else would make up the entirety of this pie?
Thanks, Senator Matthews. You want to tackle that, Senator Dibble? Ms. Mackey? Someone.
Yeah, I would just be guessing. I think there are other folks who help, and we heard from Mr. Charlo, but
maybe Commerce too would know if I could throw it to them as well.
Let's go one step at a time. Ms. Mackey, Senator Dibble, are you able to give an answer to Senator Matthews?
I would be shooting.
Not 100%.
Okay, Senator Matthews.
I know Commerce is huddling right now. Do the CAP programs fully administer these grants to the low-income people that they're helping throughout the state, or do the CAP network only do a portion of them, and who else then would help administer the rest of them?
Thank you, Senator Matthews. Sir, if you don't mind starting by saying your name for the record and your affiliation, and then answer Senator Matthews' question.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. My name is Michael Schmitz. And I'm the director of the Energy Assistance Program for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. So that's a great question. We have 28 local service providers. The majority of those are community action agencies, but we also administer the program through 5 tribal governments, 1 county government, and then 1 non-community action nonprofit, so Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota serves 1 county.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Senator Matthews.
Thank you, I appreciate that. So I'll ask Ms. Mackey first, and then I'll probably ask Commerce to answer the same question for the other entities. What's your process for dealing with eligibility, verification, and then any follow-up auditing to make sure that people that are actually needing the help are the ones that are getting helped?
Ms. Mackey.
Thank you for that question. We actually have a very in-depth process because when we receive the applications, we have a processor that's going to verify income based on paperwork provided by the household. So they're bringing their pay stubs and income information. And then we also utilize deed data that we now have access to verify that and ensure that it's accurate. And then we have a secondary person process the application, so you have 2 sets of eyes on that application before it is approved.
Thank you, Ms. Mackey. Senator Matthews.
Thank you. And then, Ms. Mackey, does your organization do any after look-backs, audits, whatnot, or is that handled up above you at Commerce, or do you just do a front-end application verification?
Ms. Mackey.
Sorry, we do the front end, and then Commerce does monitor us annually to ensure that everything was accurate.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Thank you. Then to Commerce, similar question to your other non-CAP entities, if they follow that process, and then if you would speak to what you do on the back end as far as auditing and post-verification.
Mr. Schmitz.
So we have one system that works for basically all of the service providers across the state. We have a centralized database that we call EHEAT. That's where basically all of the application information is entered. There are actually hard controls that are kind of baked into that system to ensure that all of the service providers are determining eligibility using the same criteria. So we have some consistency across income eligibility, verification, and determination. And then also all payments are managed through that. And then payments are made directly to utilities on behalf of the approved applicant. So That being said, we also audit all of our service providers annually. And then on top of that, we are audited regularly by the state auditor currently. It used to be the Office of Legislative Auditor. And then the feds will also do compliance reviews regularly to ensure that our internal control system is robust.
Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then my second question is on numbers that are reflected in the A2 amendment. In the appropriation part at the bottom, I'll ask our CAP folks first. If I'm reading the bill correctly, it's going to allow 10% of what the funding is going to be to basically be kept in-house. And that seems like a very high number to me. What's the reason, am I correct in interpreting that 10% number going to the program partners that are administering this, and why is it ending up that high?
Senator, that's for Ms. Mackey.
I believe so.
Ms. Mackey.
Thank you. I believe that is correct. And so that is what the cost of delivering the program is, because we have to pay for our staffing. And so right now we are paying for 6 staff and 3 temporary staff to deliver the federal LIHEAP program. And this would be extending that staffing over the into that summer, those summer out months. So it's on track with what our federal grants are. They've actually, many of them have increased to 15% at administrative costs. So this is actually below that, asking for the 10%.
Senator Matthews.
Mr. Chair, and that, I guess you started to answer my second question, but you've also highlighted it too. And I'm sorry, I'm not putting you and your program on the spot. This is kind of to broader CAP programs across the state. You're already getting federal funding. The infrastructure is already in place. This is, yes, adding on additional things of what you're already doing. This seems like a very high number to me as far as what could be even more money that is going out. So I guess there's not a follow-up question in there. I do want to ask the Department of Commerce. Commerce is allotted 2.5% in the bill. I know that your agency is already well-funded from multiple other forms of the general fund and everything like this. 2.5% is probably 2.5% too high, in my estimation, to your agency. Why is your agency claiming 2.5% of this grant money?
Mr. Schmitz.
So I would perhaps defer to our Director of Government Affairs on our position on the bill.
Sir, welcome to the committee. If you could start, please, by giving your name and affiliation, and then if you're able to respond to Senator Matthews' question, fire away.
Greetings, members of the committee. My name is Sam Smith. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Department of Commerce. Senator France, Senator Matthews, thank you for the question. Again, this is a bill we're neutral on. We provided some technical assistance, but the 2.5% management fee is in alignment with our fee to manage this program at the federal level.
Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don't know that I have that. That doesn't know that that answers the question any more than before. I guess I'll follow up, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your indulgence with this. In a larger sense, beyond this specific grant program, Minnesota has a very significant fraud problem. It's well documented, it's coming up in the news routinely, and it's probably sweeping in good, well-meaning organizations like our CAP partners here that are actually doing good work, because there's now legislators like me that are sitting here going, it's time to turn the spigot off until we figure out what is so broken that is losing so much of our tax dollars to waste and to fraud. So I look at numbers that are on here, and first I'm gonna basically be struggling with and questioning everybody that's getting any type of grant program anywhere, because Minnesota has such a significant fraud problem. My trust in the administration to operate this right now is zero. So I'm looking at these numbers that seem really high to me. Again, I'm going to be asking questions of all of this. To Commerce's credit, I don't believe that there's been anything that's been getting news attention of significant waste or fraud in grants that in programs that Commerce is administering. And if that's true, that's a good thing, and that needs to continue with very good vigilance and oversight, and I hope that would continue. But we definitely need to be looking at every grant dollar with a microscope that is going out, including the amount that's being kept for interagency dealings. That's going to be getting questions from me. And then I guess, let me ask my final question, Mr. Chair. The very last appropriation in there is 5% to reimburse organizations the department has contracted with to provide outreach and assistance. I guess this is probably best situated for Commerce. Why do we have an additional 5%? I'm adding all of this up. We're taking almost a 20% bite out of this hamburger before the money is getting to people that need it. Why are we having this extra 5% in here to Commerce? Are these organizations the current administrators, the CAPS and other entities that are administering this, or are these new nonprofits that are going to be created and look to take advantage of an opportunity to get some grant funding? If Commerce or someone has an answer to that, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Smith, I think that starts with you.
Chair Friend, Senator Matthews, thank you for the question. Again, this is not a Department of Commerce bill, but we're happy to provide some comments on it. We know that many people under the LIHEAP program or other energy assistance programs are not always easy to reach and not always aware of their eligibility for these services. And so investments in outreach can be a productive way to make sure people are getting the benefits they're eligible for. But happy to defer to other folks interested in the bill.
Thanks, Mr. Senator Matthews. You want to ask that of anyone else?
Yes, but Mr. Chair and Mr. Smith, this is tied to your agency, because this language is saying these are organizations that your department's going to have contracts with. So question's going to be, who's the other people that are going to get this part of the contract? Ms. Mackey, is your group going to look to fill this role? Is it going to be other entities that's going to fill that role? That's the information I'm trying to get at.
Thank you, Senator. So I think what you're saying, Mr. Smith, is this is not an agency bill, but I think what Senator Matthews is saying is if you're able to provide testimony to the extent that particular item of reimbursement, or Senator Dibble or Ms. Mackey, I think you're asking for a little more information about that part of it. So Senator Dibble, who do you think is best suited to answer this question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Ms. Mackey, Ms. Levinson-Falk, the idea here, of course, is that we're only reaching a small number of those who are eligible, and that's been a big problem and a big barrier in getting these funds out to those who need it for quite a while. But
Ms. Mackey, do you want to provide any further testimony on Senator Matthews' last question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Absolutely. We use the outreach funds to, as it says, to outreach families and households that haven't used the program, but also we use that to provide educations on things like budgeting and energy efficiency so that we can reduce the need for the program moving forward. Otherwise, like I believe you called it a Band-Aid on an existing problem. And so what we're trying to do is prevent that problem from happening in the future with those outreach dollars so that we can have folks have a better control over their household budget.
All right, thanks, Ms. Mackey. Senator Matthews?
I'll defer to now and let you do some of the other members on
okay.
your list, Senator.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Mackey, just on that last question, maybe an email to the chair and the ranking member about the number of outreach that your organization does. Maybe we can extrapolate a little bit. I think you're asking about the expense, the 2.5%. Mm-hmm. So just throwing that out there, that the committee benefits when we get information. I don't think there's anything suggested that's inappropriate or the wrong expense. I think it's more of an oversight kind of question. Is that fair, Senator Matthews? All right. Members, we have a list starting here. I have Senator Gruenhagen, then Senator Hoffman, and then Senator Zhang. Senator Gruenhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for your testimony. And Senator Dibble, I know all of us on this committee, including yourself, and I know that's why you brought the bill forward, want to help people struggling with energy costs. And I think we had testimony about people not paying their rent or even getting health care in order to pay their energy costs. And energy costs are rising exponentially, and that is a concern. I do have a question out of this. I'll try not to duplicate anything Senator Matthews mentioned, although I have very similar concerns. The other thing to understand about the energy is that a lot of the costs are being driven by government taxes, government mandates, and government regulations that are artificially inflating the cost of energy. You know, we passed the 2040 bill out of here last year. I called that bill the Obamacare of electricity. If you like your health insurance premiums, you're going to love your electricity rates. And I just got a notice from my rural co-op that my electricity rates are going up again, okay? So between the 2040 bill, which is based on the Green New Deal, which I consider to be a scam, and a lot of other people do in government now, and scientists do, and the Inflation Reduction Act, which really should have been called the Inflation Promotion Act, we're driving up the cost of non-baseload energy. And we're putting some of our most vulnerable at danger. So, you know, one other analogy with Obamacare. Here we drove up the premiums exponentially, just like we're doing electricity. And so we come along with MinSure to give people who can't afford their health insurance subsidies. Here with electricity, we're driving up the cost of electricity with the Green New scam. And then we come along and say, well, we want to give subsidies to help the people pay their pay their energy costs. Only government can come up with something like that. So, members, we need to repeal and make some exceptions to this 2040 bill, and to the degree of the Inflation Reduction Act, send the money back to the federal government to apply it to the deficit. One other thing is it's going to be an environmental disaster to clean up these windmills and these solar gardens. You know, I did want to give one personal, or actually two personal constituent stories in relationship to energy. I have a lady in a wheelchair who lives not too far from my office. She used to, it sounds like she passed away, God rest her soul. But she came over on a regular monthly basis crying because she had to decide between her prescription drugs, she'd buy herself, and paying her energy bill. So guess what I did? I wrote the check out for her energy bill, okay? Time and time and time again. So, you know, I'm more than willing to help people in these situations, personally and otherwise. But government is making it 10 times worse than it has to be. We now have 36, according to testimony, we now have 36% of the people in the state of Minnesota struggling to pay their energy bill on a Green New scam that's ruining our electric grid. And then we can't get nuclear out of this committee. Please come to your senses on this issue. You know, we can come up with all the subsidies we want, but until we attack the real problem, and energy should be penny cheap. It could be, just like when I grew up, the little NSP guy. Energy penny cheap from NSP to you. We have the technology to provide clean baseload electricity. And we're thumbing our nose at it and going down a Green New Deal scam instead. The other personal constituent that I want to share, this summer he called me up. He's a retired executive in my district. He said, Glenn, I want to meet with you. I said, that's fine. And by the way, then I'll get to my question. I said, that's fine. Where do you want to meet? We happened to meet at McDonald's in Norwood, Minnesota. So he's a retired executive. He brought me a proposal. He owns a small acreage out in the country. He was approached for a solar garden, and he showed me the proposal. He said, I want to show you this, Glenn. He said, I could get a $15,000 signing bonus and $3,000 a month for my acre to put a solar garden on for over 20 years. And we can't lower the cost of electricity for those who are hurting, but we could do that. He said, you know what his opinion was? He said, Glenn, this is the biggest scam I've ever seen in my whole life. And I said, yeah, I oppose this nonsense. And that's what we're doing. So the Green New Deal is actually killing people. We heard the testimony, freezing or too hot in summer, and now we're going to say, oh, just more tax dollars. This is economic insanity, in my opinion. Now to the question. How many nonprofits does the department work with currently to administer this program, and are we contracting with a lot more nonprofits? And the NGOs, which I define these as, have had a lot of fraud problems, both federally and state. So are we using existing ones, and do we have controls, or are we adding some new ones? That's the question.
Thank you, Senator Grunhagen. Maybe that question starts with Mr. Schmitz. Mr. Schmitz, why don't you come back to the testifier table, take a shot at it, and we'll see if that's enough for Senator Grunhagen or if you want more. Just Mr. Schmitz.
Thank you, Chair Friends. Senator Grunhagen. To your question, we work through 28 different local service providers. The majority of them are nonprofits, specifically community action agencies. But then there are 5 tribal governments, 1 county government, and then 1 other non-community action nonprofit. And so my thinking is that if this bill were to pass, that we would continue to administer through that same service provider network. And all of those service providers have been providing energy assistance for decades.
So are you?
Mr. Schmitz, I think what he's asking is, do you have a number that you work with? And if you do, that's fine. And if you don't, Senator Grunhagen, you can follow up.
Yes, so there are...
It's
23.
Are you adding new ones?
And that's not the intention of the Department of Commerce at this point.
Okay.
Senator Grunhagen.
Quick follow-up. Okay, we've had a lot of fraud with NGOs, okay, federally and state. I mean, billions, all right? Millions, billions, and, you know, pretty soon it adds up to be real money. So what oversight does the Commerce Department have to cut off funding to one of these organizations that they believe are using the money fraudulently?
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Schmitz, you want to tackle that?
Yes, definitely. That's a great question. And so the state of Minnesota has the Office of Grants Management, and there are a variety of policies to ensure that we are reviewing the financial stability of an organization before we provide an award, right? So we do that. When they have received an award, we have a centralized database that's used to ensure that they are processing applications in accordance with our policy and that they have the right verifications. We audit those applications annually, so they get that. We also do a lot of desk monitoring, so that entails through the centralized system, we have a data analyst who reviews the data and tries to identify potential fraud, and then we follow up with the service providers if we identify any sort of anomalies, right? And then after the end of a program year, we also do a closeout evaluation that assesses the effectiveness of the nonprofit organizations in administering the program as well.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Senator Grunhagen.
Real quick. Oh, thank you for that response. And Ms. Jern, just one follow-up comment, no more questions. Just make sure that you cut off funding of these people if you find there's fraud. You know, we got I could go down the list, feeding our children. I mean, they just keep sending the bills and they're saying help people and they're not helping people. So really watch the back door, okay? And then the other thing to the public that's watching, citizens, please be involved. They are ruining our grid, which should be hardened, and they're driving up the cost of electricity and energy artificially, and it doesn't need to be done. We have the technology to provide you penny-cheap electricity on a base load basis. Please participate. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Grunhagen. I think we've taken Senator Hoffman back off the list, and so we're going to go now to Senator Zhang, Vice Chair Zhang.
No, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Senator Dibble, for bringing this legislation, being part of the Capital Investment Committee and touring the state in greater Minnesota. It definitely was heart-wrenching, to say the least, to see many of the high concentration areas of where seniors were living and them just telling us stories and really going into their communities. And I think programs like these are vital in trying to help these families. Last week, there is a series of memos in relation to some of the federal freeze. I think there was a second memo from OMB that listed programs that would be temporarily paused, including Head Start, legal service grants, low-income programming, and LIHEAP was included in that. Do we know what the status of it is right now and what we might anticipate in the future? I know there are some temporary restraining orders in place, but I imagine it would impact this program that we have in the state if something were to happen to LIHEAP.
Thank you, Senator Zhang. I think that's also for Mr. Schmitz. If you have a response, thank you.
So at this point, we are able to continue to draw down funds from our federal award. We have about $112 million that we've been awarded so far this year, and we can still draw those funds down. In terms of the status of those memos, I think one of the memos was rescinded by the White House. There's also a temporary restraining order, is my understanding. Around that, so we have not received any guidance from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that provides the funding to us about making any changes to how we implement the program at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Schmitz. Senator Zhang.
No, thank you, Chair.
Members, any other questions for the testifiers? I did have a couple. Senator Dibble, thank you. Ms. Mackey, can you estimate the percentage of LIHEAP dollars that go outside the seven county metro area? And if you can't, that's fine.
I'm not
Mr.
able
Schmitz.
To.
Yeah.
I could speak to that. So over 2/3 of the funding goes to Greater Minnesota.
All right. And my next question would be, I guess, Mr. Schmitz. We've run a successful LIHEAP program, I think, so far. Have we had reports of fraud or waste in the LIHEAP program that the department's aware of?
So in my time as director of the Energy Assistance Program, which goes back to 2019, you do have occasionally, you know, individual level reports of fraud, right? So at a household level where somebody is purported to maybe have income that they haven't shared with us, but we haven't had any sort of systemic type fraud that involves a service provider or anything beyond that. One of the benefits of programs like ours is that we are paying typically the utility or a delivered fuel company on behalf of the household. And so we also have limits on how much an individual household could get. So the potential for, you know, these million-dollar frauds that are perpetrated by organizations are just fundamentally different for programs like ours compared to some of these other examples.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Senator Matthews.
Mr. Chair, I have a little information on that question because someone just this morning sent me a news article that back in 2014, this was a controversial situation going on. NPR had a report that despite warnings, state kept cash flowing to controversial nonprofit where the Commerce Department was struggling how to figure out, I believe this was one of the CAP programs, was misspending more than $1 million in energy funds. I'm happy to send the link to you, because I think it's a warning of something that absolutely should not be repeated. That's why I've been doing some checking to see how much of the news that's been going on in this administration is attributable to commerce, and the answer to our knowledge is pretty much nothing, and it needs to stay that way. There is some history in on it from much longer before Mr. Schmitz's time frame, but something that we definitely can't have repeating.
Thank you, Senator Matthews. And Senator Gruenhagen, you as well. Any involvement in fraud prevention or oversight? I think legislators are allowed to talk to the Department of Commerce and talk about the systems in place, including suggestions for improvement. I don't know if that $1 million in 2014 could have been prevented, but there's nothing wrong with any legislator from either party talking to Commerce and say, if you would have done this, maybe we wouldn't have lost $1 million in 2014. And now, Senator Green is on my list, and so we're gonna go to Senator Green. You're done, Senator Matthews. After Senator Green, we'll go to Senator McEwen. Senator Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to Senator Matthews and Gruenhagen because they asked most of my questions, so you only get one or two. I too got the notice from my local electric provider that their provider has already given notice that our electric rates are going up 8.3% just in April. And so the local utility now is trying to figure out what that means for our ratepayers. And, you know, we've got, I live in some of the poorest counties. We're going to have a real problem with that. And that's not counting when the blackout bill continues to evolve and cause more problems for us. And so the one question that hasn't been asked yet, and that is if there was a fiscal note requested on this bill. I was looking up, and it seems to me last year that there was a bill, and the fiscal note on that was like $100 million. If I remember right, maybe you can correct me on that if I'm wrong. And then if the new fiscal note, if we can get that, that it would reflect the increases that we're going to be seeing because of the blackout bill.
Thank you, Senator Green. On line 310 on page 3, it is a blank appropriation, so I don't know that we'll be able to get a fiscal note. But Senator Dibble, I think it'd be appropriate for you to speak to Senator Green's question anyway.
So, Mr. Chair, I hope we get a fiscal note at some point. I don't know if you or Mr. Mueller has one in the works or not. I think we're aiming for about, you know, $12 to $15 million per year. Remember, this is a supplemental program, and it's really focused on trying to make some of these grants throughout the year, you know, with the focus on the summertime months. It's not to come in and replace the LIHEAP program. Itself, it would be time limited. You know, we could do a pilot for 2 to 3 years to see how well it's working and whether or not it's having the intended outcome and effect that we're looking for. But I think we're going to lay this bill over and figure some of that out. And that, of course, that number is scalable. Can be anything we want it to be.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Green. Okay. I also have Senator McEwen as our last listed speaker, unless you want to ask Senator Rarick. Let's go Senator McEwen, then Senator Rarick. Senator McEwen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank you very much, Senator Dipple, for bringing this bill forward and all of the advocates in this tremendous coalition that have come together to recognize the need. I'll just note briefly that a study just in the last week or so came out that was highlighted both in the Minnesota Reformer and in the Duluth News Tribune, and it noted that at this point now, the top 1% earners in Minnesota earn about 50% of the wealth in Minnesota. And that has gone up dramatically since the 1960s, when that same group of people owned about 17% of the wealth. So we are suffering both here in Minnesota and nationwide, as we know, under record wealth inequality that the country has not maybe ever experienced, even in the 20s before the Great Depression. And that's very concerning to me, and I know concerning to a lot of people for a number of reasons. But everything that we can do to come together and just make sure that people have their basic needs met for heating, for cooling, to make sure that they and their families are safe is a really good thing. So thank you very much for all of the work that you're doing to make sure that that happens.
Thank you, Senator McEwen. Senator Rarick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was feeling a little left out if I didn't speak. I'm the last one. So, you alluded to a little bit of what my question is when you said it's scalable. But do you envision that there's a minimum number that we would have to put into this in order to move forward with it? I mean, you know, like if we have $1 million, is that just not enough to even make it worth instituting this? Do you envision that there is some type of minimum we would have to get to?
Thank you, Senator Rarick. I believe that's for you, Senator Dibble.
I'm sure there is. I don't know what that number is. Don't want to risk negotiating against myself from the table here. I want to empower Senator Friends to go and fight for the biggest target he possibly can. But we will be grateful for anything we get.
Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that also leads to a point, you know, we put in here percentages that are allowable for administration, and I think that's something we should be looking at, again, by scale. if we are able to put more in, I think the number should be lower that can go towards administration. I think it's something that I have been watching repeatedly, and I think, sadly, we have watched a number of local groups within communities that volunteered to do things like this be replaced by nonprofits that pay salaries many times when we see their 990s, people making more than the governor. And I think that's something we need to really seriously be questioning here every time we look at giving money out to nonprofits to administer programs. Could we be doing it better through local volunteer committees within our communities that know the folks who are receiving this money, who know where the need is, and have a much better grasp on finding that waste and fraud than having it be through a state agency or through a nonprofit that is not right there in that community? So I hope those are things we also consider as we move forward every time we keep talking about giving money out to some nonprofit rather than letting local community groups take care of things.
Thank you, Senator Rarick. And we're going to go to Senator Matthews, but just so you know, I made several calls to the Department of Commerce over the interim concerned about the holdback to some of our grantees, and for one-time appropriations, I felt it was too high. So count on me to continue that conversation. I love the idea of volunteers, although the stability of some of the organizations make sure we don't have gaps and we don't have all the volunteers. But amen on the question of how much the administrative cost is. I think that should be a bipartisan issue. I'll speak to bipartisanship after we go to ranking minority member, Senator Andrew Matthews. Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask counsel to read a proposed oral amendment in a moment that I'm not going to have, and I'm not going to force a vote on here today or anything. I'm trying to throw out an idea of what we're trying to get at. Just with these numbers that we're mentioning and the percentages and all of that, so I'm taking Senator Dibble's number. He said he would ideally like something in the 12.5 to 15 million. So if you take all the percentages that's in this bill, and I'm going to take 15 million as the threshold here, 17.5% of that is $2.62 million. And so if my math's correct with all of this, and if all of these percentages are correct, you're trying to tell me that you have to pay me $2.62 million for the ability to distribute the remaining $12.38 million. And I find a hard time buying that. I feel like I could come in and do it for half that price myself and do just fine. That feels like a really high number that is difficult for me to swallow. With that in mind, I've been talking here with Senate counsel next to me of one amendment idea of trying to merge some of these things in together to have some protections around some of these organizing entities and maybe trying to merge these costs into one bucket rather than multiples, if we could recognize Ms. Severson.
Thank you, Senator Matthews. Ms. Severson, do you want to just read the oral amendment? All right, Ms. Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senator Matthews moves to amend Senate File 486 as amended as follows. Page 3, line 16, after including, insert providing outreach and assistance to households to complete grant applications. Page 3, line 22, delete semicolon and insert period. Page 3, delete lines 23 to 28.
Senator Matthews, does that sound like the oral amendment you want to add?
It does, Mr. Chair. The intent of it is I'm looking at this like, why couldn't these things being listed out be merged together? I think it would be wise for us to ensure that if we're going to be doing any outreach, it probably should be these established partners that we already know and we already have a level of trust with, and not leave the door open for a new pop-up nonprofit that, hey, I'll do outreach, wink, wink, and Department of Commerce gets added to a list they don't want to get added to. And plus, I think these percentages as a whole should be looked at getting reduced way down. So that's an idea I've thrown out there of trying to maybe merge these things together, reduce and make these percentages as small as we can, and would appreciate, as Senator Dibble and the others are working on this, to maybe think through if there are ways that we can streamline this and at the very end have as much of this money as possible actually going to people that need help paying their bills.
Thank you, Senator Matthews. First, let's go to Senator Dibble. We are offering the oral amendment at this time, Senator.
I'm not going to do any more than a discussion.
All right, so Senator Matthews withdraws the oral amendment, but I still think it would be good to hear from Senator Dibble. Senator Dibble, any thoughts on the oral amendment now withdrawn?
A couple of thoughts. Thank you, Senator Matthews. One is that I think it's a perfectly fair conversation to ask specifically what is going to be done with all of this money that's described in this, you know, this administrative part. It's been emphasized to me with great strength of feeling by the CAP agencies and others that they do need a certain amount of money. A big driver for that, and you know, maybe Ms. Mackey can speak to it, is the fact that we're going from a seasonal program to a year-round program. So that is what is responsible for what is admittedly a larger percentage of administrative take from these funds. And so that's more than we would typically see. The outreach piece, in paragraph two, and I understand Senator Matthews' point, because we talk about current service providers and other organizations opening up the door to, you know, folks kind of getting in here to try to get a taste of this money. I'm very much want to talk about keeping the provision of these services within the organizations and the network that's already established. And perhaps we can get some language in here. I do think we need a better understanding of what outreach is. I obviously didn't fully understand what that was because I gave a partial answer, and then Ms. Mackey expanded to help us understand that it's also about budgeting and managing the use of your utilities and energy, et cetera. So there's a lot more to what outreach exactly is. We can get some better definition of what that is so we have a better understanding of what's happening. So all of this is a long-winded way of saying I'm wide open to this conversation and some of these ideas that are offered in the amendment, and grateful that we're not offering it now because it's a lot to react to quickly. But we'll continue the conversation maybe outside of this room.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Matthews. All right. Other questions, members? The chair's got a comment or two on the bill before we lay it over. Senator Dibble, I'll give you closing comments. First of all, Mr. Mueller pointed out, if you're following this, that the federal appropriation for this program for fiscal year 2026 is $150,400,000, and then for fiscal year 2027, $150 million. So for context, that's what the current plan is at the federal government to come in and help Minnesotans with their energy costs. That's kind of where we are. Mr. Schmitz, I see you raise an eyebrow. Mr. Mueller's never wrong.
So last year we received about $125 million, and given the way that that Congress has been finalizing budgets, I don't know, the idea of it increasing by $25 million seems a bit unrealistic to me. I would expect it to be $125 million this year and next. That would be, I think, a hopeful perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Schmitz. We do handicap the federal government once in a while, but this sheet says commerce at the top of it, so I read it, and there we are, and we'll have to figure out the last $25 million later. Just one committee. Senator Grunhagen, I just wanted to point out that the nuclear subsidies are fairly substantial, and so I think it's a fair point about cost and about the reliability of base load. I wanted to acknowledge MREA and MMUA, Senator Dibble, testifiers, members. These are our rural co-ops and our municipals, and we depend on them, Senator Grunhagen, to come before this committee and tell us where they're concerned and where they're supportive. And I'm struck by their supportive testimony. Not quite finished yet, Senator Grunhagen. I let you speak. As we talk about the rates, too, I tried to do a little math, and I think my take is that the energy costs for Minnesotans over the last 10 years have risen roughly in line with the national average on inflation. So we do want to have low cost. We can build more energy of whatever type we want, the lower the cost. So count on me, Senator Matthews, to partner up where we think it's good. We have to factor in, is there a cost to climate change and those changes? And we don't have to agree on that today, Senator Grunhagen. But we do want to consider all costs when we value renewable against the other sources. And I was going to adjourn the hearing, Senator Grunhagen, but perhaps you just want a little more comment. Senator Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just one comment on nuclear. The reason we got to help subsidize nuclear is because of government taxes, regulations, and mandates, and all the lawsuits by environmentalist group. I have an insurance client who does testing technology on nuclear facilities all around the country. I've had him for about 20 years. And he said the amount of government red tape on these things artificially inflates the cost. So what happens? Then government comes along and gives them subsidies. I mean, that's, we're doing the same thing here. First, government causes the problem. Then they come up with the, well, we'll give you more of our money from somebody over here.
Thanks, Senator Grunhagen. I'll tell you what I'll do for you, because I like you. You and I and our friends at Xcel Energy can meet offline to talk about the subsidies available for nuclear, how they factor in, and, of course, on costs. We want to know if the cost overruns in the Georgia nuclear project are something that are unusual or usual, and how do we factor that in. Finally, Senator Matthews, to the question of bipartisanship, I want you to know I had a member of this committee say to me today before the hearing, finally, you're going to hear a Democrat bill. We'll total up at the end of the session the number of bills from each party and what bills are included in the Senate omnibus, and you have my pledge that it'll represent both parties well on the things that are important to them. We'll run them through the committee, we'll see where the votes are, and we'll go from there. And with that, I'm going to give Senator Dibble the last word before we lay this bill over. Fair enough? All right, Senator Dibble, to your bill before the committee lays it over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you made some of the points I was going to make in conclusion. You know, a lot of focus and discussion about the price of energy, but really the focus of this bill, as I said before, is extending LIHEAP to the summer months. 2024 was the hottest year on record in Minnesota, following several years prior, on and off, hottest years on record. And to the points that were made by our testifiers, people are experiencing shutoffs and people are experiencing health consequences from lack of access to their energy needs in the summertime months. So that's really what we're trying to do here. We're not responding to necessarily to increasing energy prices. That is a factor, but like everything, you know, prices go up, but they don't have access to these kinds of supports. And it's also responding to, you know, the issue that Senator McEwen raises. We got more and more people working harder and harder, making less and less money because fewer and fewer people are controlling more and more of the dollars that are available in this state. So the upstream solution is making sure that we share the prosperity of the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. With that, members, Senate File 486 is laid over for possible inclusion. That bill will be heard again in this committee, and we'll talk about it offline as well. Senator Dibble, thank you to the testifiers. Thank you. Thanks for making the trip. Members, we have hearings coming up on the 10th. There is still a tiny bit of room. If a member of this committee wants to have a bill heard, Republican or Democrat, come see the chair. Be happy to talk a little bit more about it. Also, we're going to have the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce stop back by on the 12th to talk about their budget. We're going to move forward. With that, the Senate Energy, Utilities, Environment, and Climate Committee is adjourned.